We will reconvene the Fish and Wildlife Commission meeting. Hope everyone had a nice lunch. We are now at agenda item number 6, Coastal Commercial Dungeness Crab Whale Entanglement and Conservation Plan Development. This is a briefing with public comment. Heather Hall, please.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Carpenter and commissioners. My name is Heather Hall. I'm the Intergovernmental Policy Coordinator for the department. I'm here today to give you an update on the progress of our Coastal Commercial Dungeness Crab Conservation Plan. We've brought this issue to the commission a few times over the last couple of years. Given that there are some new commissioners, I would like to start off with a brief background of the situation and review the actions that have been taken up to this point. Then I'll walk you through the conservation plan, providing a summary of the different components that make up the plan, and I'll conclude with an overview of our expected timeline and next steps. In recent years, there's been an increase in entanglements with marine life protected by the ESA and by the MMPA and commercial Dungeness crab gear off the West Coast, including off Washington. To ensure compliance with the ESA, WDFW indicated our intent to apply for an incidental take permit for the coastal crab fishery under Section 10 of the ESA from National Marine Fisheries Service back in 2018. A conservation plan is required before we can initiate the application process. WDFW staff began drafting the conservation in 2020, and I would note that a similar process is underway in Oregon and California. But we began taking steps to respond to the increased entanglements beginning in 2017. This slide shows you the history of confirmed entanglements off the West Coast going back to 2000. And between 2000 and 2013, entanglements remained relatively stable, averaging about 10 per year for the entire West Coast. Between 2013 and 2019, we started to see an increase in entanglements. And for the purposes of our conservation plan, we view this period as the modern era of entanglements, and it really serves as our baseline reference point for the document. It also shows entanglements peaking in 2015 and 2016. Many of those entanglements were associated with California fisheries and can be linked to a significant harmful algal bloom event that resulted in the commercial crab fishery season opening being delayed until late spring compared to the traditional opening around December. In addition, you can also see that the entanglements were largely driven by entanglements with humpback whales, which are the light blue color here. And that's significant because, as you heard in the earlier report from the wildlife program, some population segments of humpback whales off the Washington coast are listed under the Endangered Species Act. So this slide only goes through 2019, but we do have preliminary data through October of 2020. There were reports of 16 confirmed entanglements and 10 unconfirmed entanglements for a total of 26 total entanglement reports for the entire West Coast. Of those, 10 were confirmed to be entanglements with humpback whales, and 3 of those confirmed entanglements were associated with Dungeness crab gear. Of the 3 associated with Dungeness crab gear, 2 were with humpbacks, 1 in California and 1 in Oregon. And the 1 Washington entanglement was with a gray whale. So this slide really breaks down the West Coast look at entanglements to those that are specific to confirmed entanglements with Washington crab gear. And it also is from that baseline period of 2013 to 2019, of which there are 10. So you can see that other than the entanglement in 2015, really the increase in entanglements in Washington were largely not observed until 2017 and 2018. So we had the one humpback entanglement in 2015. There were no entanglements reported in 2016. In 2017, there were three entanglements, one with a gray whale and two humpback whales. In 2018, we had five entanglements. Two were with humpback whales and three were with gray whales. And then again, in 2019, there was just one entanglement with a humpback whale, and with the preliminary data, that one entanglement with a gray whale and no entanglements with humpback whales. So going back to my earlier point that while we started really digging into our work on the conservation plan in 2020, we started actively addressing the entanglement issue early on. Our first step was to learn more about it with funding from NOAA's bycatch reduction program and facilitation provided by the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. A Washington whale entanglement working group was established in the fall of 2017. WDFW staff and members of the whale working group attended two West Coast entanglement workshops hosted by NOAA to learn about the science of entanglements. WDFW staff, industry stakeholders, and tribal representatives, with the help of scientists and other experts, spent much of 2018 learning about whale migration patterns, entanglement science, and gear options. The Whale Entanglement Working Group provided a forum to better understand the issue from a very Washington perspective and led to the development of a best practices guide for the Washington coastal crab fishery. And then again, in 2018 is when we initiated our request to NIMS that we would be applying for an incidental take permit. The following spring, WDFW staff began working with National Marine Fisheries Service, along with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and California Department of Fish and Wildlife, to understand what the process of securing an incidental take permit looked like. At the same time, we began working with our stakeholders to discuss and develop regulations to immediately reduce the risk of entanglements in the coastal crab fishery. In the summer of 2019, we implemented an emergency rule to reduce the number of pots used in the fishery. And in the fall, we briefed the commission on proposed permanent regulations. And in January 2020, the commission adopted those permanent regulatory changes, all intended to reduce the risk of entanglements. And I'll walk you through what those are a little later in the presentation. We also participated along with scientists from the Northwest and Southwest Fishery Science Center, West Coast crab managers, and industry representatives in a West Coast science policy workshop to start bringing scientists and fishery managers together to start tackling solutions to this problem. And I think I've said this a couple times since we really started focusing our work on drafting our conservation plan. So what is a conservation plan? In very general terms, conservation plan needs to describe the fishery, quantify the risk it poses to covered species, and needs to include specific management measures that will reduce the risk of entanglements, adaptive management, which will describe what we'll do to maintain compliance with the terms of the incidental take permit, and a monitoring program for compliance and assessing the effectiveness of our management approach. So, and I just want to say here, the approach of our conservation plan isn't too different from what we already do or what we have done. We didn't really have to reinvent the wheel. WDFW's management approach for the coastal crab fishery is always aligned with the agency's overall mission to provide harvest opportunities in a way that preserves and protects the resource, but also in a way that minimizes harms to other species and habitats. So this, I'm going to walk you quickly through the different sections of the conservation plan. It starts out with an introduction, which includes the purpose and the need, a description of the fishery. Section 3 is a description of the environment and the covered species. And Section 4 describes our anticipated impacts to the covered species. Section 5 is a big one. It includes the goals and objectives, the entanglement risk and the impact reduction measures, our monitoring and reporting program, and our adaptive management program. Section 6 describes the plan implementation. Section 7 is the funding sources and assurances that those sources will be in place through the terms of the permit. And Section 8 are the alternatives. So for the purpose and need, we really hear it just communicates our biological goals and objectives for ESA listed species and our commitment to avoiding and minimizing impacts to these species from activities associated with the coastal commercial crab fishery. And for the covered fishery and species, our conservation plan requests coverage for humpback whales, blue whales, and leatherback sea turtles in the coastal crab fishery. And the term of our incidental take permit is we're requesting over a period of 20 years. So the Washington crab fishery does not have a recorded history of entangling blue whales or leatherback sea turtles. They are a more uncommon species off our coast, but they have been found entangled in other Dungeness crab gear, specifically off California. But we know they're present off the Washington coast, and the crab fishery has the potential to entangle them. So we've included them there just due to that risk. The potential for entanglement. And we know that the fishery has a history of entangling gray whales. They're not ESA listed, so they're not requested to be covered under our conservation plan, but we do discuss them in the conservation plan, and many of the measures that we've implemented to reduce the risk to humpback whales and blue whales and leatherback turtles will also reduce the risk of entangling gray whales. So when we talk about the description of the fishery, you know, this is a common graphic we show. It's the coastal commercial crab fishery is considered one of the most economically significant commercial fisheries off the Washington coast. It has an average ex-vessel value of $43 million. This slide is specific to 2019, where the ex-vessel value was $44 million. And you can just see how that applies to other commercial fisheries on the West Coast. It's not just important for the participants in the crab fishery, but it's also important to vulnerable coastal communities where the fishery operates. And we co-manage this fishery with four coastal treaty tribes in the area north of Point Chehalis, north of or near Grace Harbor. This slide is another graphic showing a little description of the fishery. And in terms of fishing timing and fishing effort, this is what the fishery really looks like. It's very fast paced, and the bulk of the season harvest is caught early in the year. So the season can start as early as December. You can see here it only has two times in the last couple of years. The season really starts after we've determined that the molt period for the male population has completed and there's no soft crab. So that'll often bring us to a fishery towards the end of December, early January. It starts out with a lot of fishing effort here through March and April, and then just naturally drops off as catch declines and fishing effort starts to naturally decline. And so also from May through September is when we expect to see more humpback whales off the Washington coast. So there's a natural reduction in the amount of gear and effort in the water that occurs during a sensitive time of the year. So the conservation plan also includes a description of the environment. It includes information on familiar ocean indicators like El Nino and La Nina, describes marine heat waves such as the blob, which can impact toxic algae blooms. It can result in shifts in prey availability. This section also describes general ocean warming and ocean acidification. And we know that the environment off the Washington coast is highly dynamic. Environmental changes can have strong influence on the abundance and distribution of marine organisms, which can then influence entanglement risk. A really good example of that is when humpbacks are typically feeding farther offshore on krill, they're away from the crab fishery. But in years when the krill abundance is low, humpbacks may shift their feeding closer into shore to feed on anchovy. And this is where we see increased entanglement risk. This next slide gives you a side-by-side view of just one example of humpback whale abundance off the Washington coast. This is from 2016, and it's from the time period of April to October. So here you can see in the red, a higher abundance off the Northwest Washington coast area. And then this graphic on the right, this is using our coastal Dungeness crab logbook data. Starting in 2014 through 2019, it summarizes all of the fishing effort over those years together. And you can see that a lot of our fishing effort is concentrated in our central to southern Washington coast. This red line here is the 30 fathom line. So much of our fishing effort is inside 30 fathoms, but it does extend offshore and also down into Oregon. So looking ahead, we're working with the Northwest and Southwest Science Centers to build on current knowledge, both on the timing of whales off the Washington coast. We have a partnership with the Science Centers. They're using our logbook to see how whales and crab gear overlap. I think this is one of the things that is pretty exciting about this collaboration with scientists. And then we look forward to being able to use ecosystem data to develop predictive tools to help us be responsive and avoid entanglements as much as possible. It's really these kind of tools that'll help us be more precise rather than blunt with any needed adaptive management measure. And that ability to be more refined and flexible will benefit not only the covered species, but also fishery participants. So this slide walk you through our anticipated take. And I say here at the right in the heading, this is preliminary. And this goes back a little bit to the discussion that you had with the wildlife program too. There's a lot of new information out there on the stocks that we really want to think carefully about. But for now, what we've got in our draft conservation plan for humpback whales, and this does include delisted animals. So for all entanglements, we're requesting or anticipating a take of about 2 animals per year, or less than or up to 40 animals over the 20-year permit period. For blue whales, it's less than 1 animal per year, equating to about 1 animal every 5 years. And over the course of the 20-year permit, estimating approximately for the take of 4 animals. For leatherback turtles, much less than 1 animal per year, equating to about 1 animal every 10 years or 2 over the 20-year permit period. Our anticipated take is based on the entanglement record, and we know we must be conservative to account for uncertainty. So not only uncertainty with regard to entanglements that don't have gear specifically associated with the Washington Dungeness crab fishery, so entanglements with unidentified gear, or entanglements with unidentified whales. We know that not every entangled whale is observed. And so we're taking that into account in our anticipated take. And then again, as was referenced in the wildlife report earlier before lunch. Most humpbacks off Washington, we estimate around 63% are from the Hawaiian distinct population segment, which are delisted. And so this is important when thinking about our request to take 40 animals over the course of 20 years, just noting that not all of those takes will be on stocks that are listed under the endangered, under as endangered or threatened under the ESA. And again, just highlight that we're using preliminary here because we're really working to better understand some of this new stock data information and how it relates to our anticipated take. And Washington is really unique when you think about the delisted whales that are present off the Washington coast and not necessarily off Oregon or California. So we need time to work through that. Just relative to the take for humpbacks and blue whales, we haven't had any more than two humpback entanglements attributed to our fishery in a single year. And we've had no recorded entanglements of blue whales or leatherback turtles attributed to the coastal crab fishery. So section five is really the conservation program. It includes the goals and objectives, conservation measures, our monitoring and reporting program, performance and success criteria, and our adaptive management strategy. Getting into the details of Section 5, we have an overarching vision for our goals and objectives, and that is that we want to have a thriving fishery that operates alongside recovering populations of humpback whales, blue whales, and leatherback turtles. And then, as I mentioned a couple of slides back, our agency's mission and our fishery management policies really serve to guide WDFW staff in that first half of the vision. And then our conservation program goal is focused on actualizing the second half of the vision, and that is to reduce the risk of entanglements the fishery poses for covered species. So we've broken the goal down into measurable objectives that we hope to achieve during the 20-year permit period, starting with just simply reducing the number of vertical lines in the water, facilitating gear innovation, providing education and outreach, improve our fishery monitoring, and filling critical information gaps. Oops, too fast. So this slide are the conservation measures. And these are the measures I spoke about earlier that the commission adopted and were implemented in 2020. These really are the foundation of our conservation plan. These are the management measures that will reduce the risk of entanglements, and starts with a 1/3 pot limit reduction effective every year, day one. It includes a requirement for a summer buoy tag that's also aligned with that May 1 start date. That summer buoy tag then allows us to expand our derelict gear recovery period and start that much sooner. We've also required line marking. This is a provision that was recommended in the Washington Best Practices Guide. We now, all fishermen are required to mark their line with 12 inches of red at the top of the line and 12 inches of red at the bottom of the line. And then we also have reduced the number of replacement tags that are available throughout the season. These measures were really informed by what we know about the timing of entanglements in Washington. So again, they start in May for the line reduction and the gear recovery program that is focused on getting lines out of the water during the critical period. The line marking is really key to addressing the data gap associated with entanglement records in which the gear can't be identified. So this is really also important for our monitoring program of our conservation plan. It'll give us another tool to use to monitor the effectiveness of the Washington-specific conservation plan. And we can show that these tools reduce risk, but through monitoring, we'll also need to be able to show that these are effective tools. So that really gets us to this monitoring program. And say here with a big exclamation, this is definitely a work in progress. This is a part of the conservation plan that we're still really working on developing. It is a required component of the conservation plan, and the monitoring program must track compliance with the permit terms and conditions. It must track the impacts the fishery has on species of concern, and it must track progress and achievement of the conservation program goals and objectives. So this has been very challenging, trying to decide what an effective monitoring program looks like. So historically, when you think about the entanglement report, those entanglement reports have been really collected exclusively opportunistically. But that type of reporting, as you saw on the slide above, which is conducted by National Marine Fisheries Service, it doesn't meet the minimum requirements for incidental take permit issuance. And then when you think about observer programs, you might commonly think of like an onboard observer, which are commonly used to monitor bycatch in other fisheries. But this would really be an impractical tool for monitoring entanglements. So we definitely need more creative thinking here. And I would say this is, we're not alone in this being a little bit stuck here and needing to dig a little bit harder. We're working together with our managers in Oregon and California to talk about how we do this in all of our fisheries. So again, work in progress there. Relative to electronic monitoring and fishery monitoring, we're really excited to have a pilot project operating in the fishery this year. We were just approved for that with funding from the National Fish and Wildlife Federation. So we have two vessels fishing under this first stage of the pilot program, and they have the full system that includes RFID tags on buoys that are recorded each time they come across the block and onto the boat. And then there's also a camera system. This electronic monitoring program also functions as a electronic logbook reporting. So you wouldn't need to fill out a paper logbook. And then together with this, we worked with Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, who also had some money. We have some additional systems on other vessels that don't have the full camera capability. So we're really looking at a lot of different things in this pilot project. It's initially targeted again at two vessels, and we hope to expand that to 12 vessels next year. It would be through a separate funding request, but we're hopeful that that'll go through. And this is a very similar system to what is used by the Quinault Indian Nation for their coastal commercial crab fishery. So in addition to it supporting our conservation plan, it also is a really necessary tool for effective state tribal co-management. This has been a long time coming and a conversation we've had with the Quinault tribe over many years. So we're really happy to say that we have got this ball rolling in terms of electronic monitoring. And I would say that even though it's really focused as a fishery monitoring tool, it also brings us one step closer to more of a real-time monitoring for entanglements as well. And it's just relevant technology that'll continue to develop and I think continue to support management tools relative to entanglement risk in the future.
Heather, if I may, Commissioner Anderson has his hand up.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, the question you brought up, the that Quinault has been using a similar system and that this is will mesh nicely with that. I'd been wondering, I believe that this conservation plan and the incidental take permit application is Washington State alone, and it does not cover the treaty tribes. Is that correct?
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Anderson, that's correct. I should have said that this is state specific. We have coordinated with the tribes and let them know the management approach we're taking, but this is very specific to the state fishery.
And I assume that the tribes probably do a Section 7 or some form of consultation for their fishery.
I'm not sure of the specifics of that, but I think you're right. It would be a different process than what we go through.
Okay.
Commissioner Smith, please.
I've got two questions. The first is those numbers, those take numbers that you showed us in the chart, are those maximum so that if we were to exceed those numbers in any given year, does that close the fishery down? So that's question number one. My second question is, I'm aware of at least one research project. It was Lebon and Kelly, published in 2019 on alternative gear. Is there, should we hope that there might be some additional solutions there? I mean, limiting the fishery is, obviously has very big economic impacts if there were other ways to do that.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Smith, thank you for the questions. Those are really good questions. So we still have some conversations to have with NIMS and our coordination and relative to what would happen if we reached one of those anticipated takes. Because we know that entanglements can happen, we certainly wouldn't expect them to happen exactly two entanglements every year. Right? They could be three entanglements in one year and no entanglements for the next six. But the way we have it here, it looks like we would be exceeding it in one year, even though we wouldn't be exceeding it over the terms of the permit. So we don't expect it to close the fishery. But how we describe that in a way that reflects what might happen naturally in the environment, as long as we're not exceeding that that take level over the long term, is how what we're working with NIMS to describe better. So whether or not that's a longer average take over 5 years, what we really expect to happen if we reach those expected take numbers is a consultation with NIMS. Okay, this is what happened. This is why we think it happened. These are the actions we're taking to make sure it doesn't happen next year. And that is what I'm expecting to happen rather than a fishery closure. And then I'm going to talk about alternative gear a little bit here farther in the presentation. We do hope that there's other gear modifications that can be made rather than just continuing to put restrictions on, fishing effort and fishing area. So there are some promising tools, and you'll see a little later on, we hope to create a pathway to allow those to be tested specifically in Washington.
Okay. I apologize for jumping the gun on that. Let's have you continue.
That's okay. Great. So let's see. I think I'm moving on to the next slide here. So this slide really is how we're looking at measuring our performance and success criteria. So it's not really just good enough to say we're going to put a pot limit in place and we're going to reduce the amount of replacement tags you can get and create a derelict gear recovery program that's expanded. We have to really show and quantify what that means. They have to be tools that are effective but also measurable. So in this this table here, this first line, this is our baseline period, the 2013 to 2019. And on average over those years for each month, these are the number of pots that are fished. And you can see they're focused on really the May through September period, but we've also included April and March for a little bit broader context. And then the row below it is what we expect to see in 2023 and through 2040 during the permit period, hopefully. And that percent reduction from the baseline and what we expect to see with the cumulative effect of not just the pot limit, but also the gear recovery program and eliminating replacement tags is a reduction that ranges anywhere from 37% to 43%. That's the number of lines in the water. We've also got 2019 and 2020 on here, which is our most recent complete season, and the reduction from 2020. You can see the reduction amounts are there, but it's like a lot of fisheries in 2020. We do have an asterisk by it. It was, you know, significantly affected by the pandemic. So when you look at that, it's just for a little bit of frame of reference. But again, this is the kind of criteria we need to show in our conservation plan that shows that our tools are effective. And then adaptive management, this is helps us account for uncertainty. So it's a tool that will allow us to promote flexible decision-making and allow us to adjust our decisions as outcomes and other relevant events become better understood. So to put this into more solid ideas. So adaptive management tools that we would be looking at include pot limits. So for example, expanding the time, the area, or a combination of that where pot limits are in place, looking at closed areas, potentially seaward of 30 fathoms, and then gear modifications, stuff that we're looking at, such as weak buoy links. And what those are is a weak link between the line and the pot that if it's faced with a significant amount of tension, such as what would happen if it was entangled on a whale, it would break rather than drag that pot around, or exploring ideas like floating, sinking, and neutral line, or even multiple pots per line. So you would have one line with two pots at the bottom. And then something that comes up a lot is this idea of pop-up gear. But all of these gear modifications need more exploration. I think especially pop-up gear. Again, we have this fishery operates in the winter primarily. And so thinking about using this type of gear in our extreme ocean conditions, it just calls for some real testing before we would implement rules like that. But there are definitely things that we think can help in the future. And then using electronic monitoring to help us with real-time fishery data and maybe even potentially other effort reductions such as pot stacking, which is a concept where you have we have two licenses and each one has a pot limit associated with it. And you combine those two together and you have a number of pots that's less than the two separate licenses and you have one less vessel participating. So it's similar to a buyback in terms that it reduces effort. But those are our long-term ideas and things that we're looking toward using for our adaptive management program. And when we think about what would trigger the need for adaptive management, you know, we look at things that are monitoring related, you know, exactly what you brought up, Commissioner Smith, maybe not meeting our objectives or exceeding take. So how do we make sure that that doesn't happen and adjust to maybe new information? Perhaps adaptive management is triggered by environmental factors like a marine heat wave or a harmful algal bloom. And I'll just share the experience we had this year with the opening of the Dungeness crab fishery and how it's related to harmful algal blooms and how that relates to entanglement risk. We just got our fishery underway less than 2 weeks ago on February 16th. And that's again compared to a typical season opening, which opens sometime mid-December. But that was related to high domoic acid that we've had on the coast. And this is really similar to what delayed the opening of the California crab fishery back in 2015 and contributed to their increased entanglements. So as we were thinking through the domoic acid situation this year and opening the fishery, we really had to think about what was approaching us in March and April and May. The longer we prolonged the season opening, we pushed ourselves up against the period of time where we might have that entanglement risk. So I think it was just a real life example of how we might need an adaptive, flexible approach in our conservation plan. And then another component of adaptive management is informational. So as new information becomes available, we have new and improved technology or new information, we can respond to that through adaptive management. So section 6 of the conservation plan is plan implementation. It really just, it gives us an opportunity to describe what would happen under changed or unforeseen circumstances. It includes an amendment process and describes when a major or a minor amendment to the permit would be needed. It also discusses permit renewal, transfer, suspension. And we just spoke to NIMS about this in our last coordination meeting, where permit renewal just, it isn't automatic. So after the 20-year period, it wouldn't just automatically reviewed if we don't outline that in our that process in our conservation plan that we're putting forward now. Section 7 is where we describe our funding sources, the costs with associated with implementing the conservation plan, which include our conservation strategy, monitoring and reporting, and our adaptive management measures. A lot of this is just our staff time, but what NIMS will need to see is that, and what WDFW will need to provide is that we can, we have the funding sources and assurances that they'll be in place for the terms of the permit. And then the final section of the conservation plan discusses alternatives. And the section 10 of the ESA requires that we discuss the alternatives to the taking of species and why they aren't implemented. So an example of that, one alternative would be that we completely close the commercial Dungeness crab fishery. As we describe why that alternative isn't implemented, you know, we can speak to it may be overly an overarching response to a problem that isn't necessary, but also obvious to everyone is the economic impact that would have on not just the license holders, but our coastal communities. So for our timeline and next steps, we had initially thought we would have a draft conservation plan by the end of 2020. We came really close to that, and we have a really fairly complete first draft is what I would call it. But it's been a complex process, and it's required a lot of engagement with National Marine Fisheries Service, with other West Coast managers, with our stakeholders, and we're all learning as we go. Again, it's also, I talked about this a little bit, and I think it's an important point, is the science is really still developing. We have new information on the status of the stocks. There'll be new stock assessments out soon. We are starting to see some exciting products coming in the form of forecasting and predictive models that the science centers are working on. We're making really good state improvements in our state data collection. And so we think a more realistic timeline looks like what you see here. So in January, we reconnected with the science centers and researchers and National Marine Fisheries Service to talk about some of these forecasting tools, see the progress on what they had done since our last science policy workshop. February, this is where we are today, giving you an update. And then from March to September, we really are looking to complete the draft, continue our National Marine Fisheries Service coordination, focus on the really big missing or big gap in terms of fully developing our monitoring program. And then I'll speak a little bit more about this on the next slide, but in June and August, we anticipate bringing a follow-up rulemaking package to the commission that just builds on what we did in 2020. These aren't as big of changes that we made for 2020, but they'll supplement what we already have done. And then we expect to present a final draft for review to the director late in the fall. And once we have that, we'll distribute the final conservation plan to the commissioners. And then we can follow up in the winter with proceeding with our incidental take permit application. Oh, went too fast, excuse me. So relative to changes that we have been discussing for 2021, I mentioned this a little bit earlier in the presentation. We've been discussing these changes with our stakeholders, and these changes would completely eliminate the replacement buoy tag program. If you remember from before in 2020, we reduced the number of replacement tags. This would just take it the next step and just replace it all or remove it altogether. And I would say, and you'll hear about this when we come to you in June, but that's really kind of organically happened. We have very few fishermen requesting replacement tags. I think the new summer buoy tag program will help a lot with that. And we're also looking to move to mandatory electronic fish ticket reporting. We have at least 80% reporting done electronically via a voluntary reporting, but we want to put that in place as a requirement for everyone. And that just really gives us more timely fishery data that I think will be really important. And then again, when we're looking at these rule changes, we want to make sure that there's a regulatory pathway to allow some gear testing. So we need to look at the rules that we have in place for experimental gears and make sure that we can do that in a way that has a close linkage with fishery managers, so we know what's happening out there, and of course our enforcement, but also gets that testing done in a real world environment where it would potentially be used. So I'm not sure if a rule change is there or needed there or not, but we'll be looking into that before June. And then we've also considered tools to improve the identification of recreational crab gear. So that would be similar to the line marking that we're required for the commercial fishery. It's something we've thought about, but I don't think we're ready to move in that direction yet, although we're going to keep thinking about it. And then finally, there is an existing commission policy on that includes management objectives for the coastal crab fishery. And we think that an update to that policy will likely be needed in the future just to maintain management alignment with our agency's mission, but also the commitment to reducing entanglement risk as described in the conservation plan, which isn't already included in our current policy. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Heather, would you mind if Fred, what I'd like to do here, if we may, I'd like to go to the public comment piece. And that might clear up some questions, might add some additional questions to the list, and then we can come back and wrap up. We're getting a little bit behind here on our scheduling. So if there's no objection to that, I'd like to go to the public comment section, Heather.
Okay. Sounds good, Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Nikki, we have public comments.
Yeah, we'll now take public comment from attendees. As a reminder, Everyone receives 3 minutes for comment. If you're pre-registered, we still ask you to raise your hand so we can see you in the queue. Everyone's currently muted. If you're on the computer, the raise hand button appears under your name. If you're on the phone, please press star 9 and wait to hear you've been unmuted. That's your indication it is your turn to speak. Okay, first, I'm going to say your name wrong again, Larry. I'm sorry. Larry Fevick, followed by Dale Beasley. Go ahead, Larry.
You're really close. It's Thievic. So before I start, I would like to commend Heather Hall for her very thorough presentation of a pretty complex procedure we're all going through. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, once again, my name is Larry Thievic. I'm the president of the Washington Dungeness Crab Fishermen's Association. As noted, the Dungeness crab fishery is the lifeblood of our coastal fishing communities. While any entanglement is bad for both fishers and whales, documented incidents of humpback entanglements with Washington coastal crab gear is relatively low and represents less than 10% of total coastwide gear entanglements. No fisher wants to entangle a whale, but it is important to note in the plan that over 60% of the humpback whales that visit the Washington coast are expected to be non-listed whales. So when an entanglement does occur in the Washington coastal crab fishery, it is as likely to be a non-listed Hawaiian humpback as it is to be a listed humpback. For the conservation plan to be an effective document, access to timely stock assessment data is critically important. Data on the DPS strength of the endangered Central American population was reported as 8 years old and unreliable in 2016 and is no better now, 5 years later. While data on overall humpback populations of the Washington, Oregon, California stock was gathered in two population studies in 2018, we continue to wait for a NOAA updated stock assessment review from the 2018 data. As is mentioned earlier, a technical memo of one of the 2018 studies has been released by NOAA, and preliminary estimates from that memo demonstrate West Coast humpback populations have grown at least 60 to 70% in the last 5 years. Without updated and accurate data, it will be impossible to fully understand the impacts of entanglements and effectiveness of mitigation. Just knowing the number of entanglements will not quantify the actual impacts of those entanglements against the backdrop of increasing or decreasing whale populations. Potential modifications to take requests in the plan's 20-year time frame must not get buried in a lengthy and cumbersome plan amendment process. The plan needs to have a reasonable mechanism built in to accommodate justified increase take requests or necessary decrease requests if dramatic population changes up or down are observed. The conservation plan requires a description of potential adaptive management measures, including potential gear innovations. We support potential gear innovations, but some innovations are likely not the panacea some presently perceive. A proposed innovation for ropeless gear or pop-up gear would likely have severe and disruptive impacts on the fishery, prove too costly, impractical, and may, if data proves, be unnecessary for the health of whale populations. The likelihood of any proposed ropeless gear innovations may work somewhere, but will not work well in wind, wave, tidal events, and pot densities in Washington. The conservation plan is a complex document, and without good data may lead us down a false path.
We're out of time, Larry.
I applaud the work and the dedication done by the staff, and I look forward to a review of the draft document before it is submitted, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your comments today, Larry. Next, Nikki, please.
Next and last is Dale Beasley. Go ahead, Dale. Or Rachel. Okay, we're going to call it a Rachel.
I assume that you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Yeah, my name is Dale Beasley. I'm president of the Coalition of Coastal Fisheries and the Columbia River Crab Fishermen's Association. And I want to support Larry Thievic's testimony. It was great. Heather did a good job as well. I'm glad to see that. I had a couple of comments in addition to those. The whale information and stock data assessment is light and often old that we're trying to make decisions upon. Most of these stocks have been increasing at 7 to 8% a year, which means that the stock status can double in as short as 9 or 10 years. And as far as I know, our fishery in Washington has never entangled a leatherback sea turtle. Neither have we entangled a blue whale. So a lot of this that we look at in this plan is hoped speculation and hope that we never catch either one of those in the future. I'd also like to draw your attention to the fact that I was a little derelict in getting my written comments in. I didn't send those in until this morning. And I hope that the commission would take the time to read those, because in my estimation as a 45-year fisherman and watching the way the fishing industry has been going on the Washington coast, I think that our fisheries on the coast are in more fear of extinction than any of these whale populations are. So I always want you to think about it when we're looking at regulation in the future, whether it's on whales or other fisheries, that all of these regulations are cumulative to impact on what I call the fisher go hungry insanity in the crab fishery. This winter, we've had a number of casualties that have affected our fishery. We've had more casualties in our fishery this winter than we'll probably have whale entanglements coming up the rest of the year. And I always like you to think cumulative regulations have an impact on our Dungeness crab fishery. It's the most dangerous fishery in the United States. We have the highest fatality rate of any occupation in the entire nation in Dungeness crab in the Northwest at 466 per 100,000. That's way higher than the nursing home deaths in New York City from COVID-19, which everybody is deploring. So just think about the impacts not only to fish, but to our entire fishing industry from some of these regulations that we face in the future. And the regulations that industry and WDF have come up with to address this whale entanglement issue, even though it's small, is a reasonable solution that the fleet supports moving forward. And we'd like to appreciate and thank WDF for working closely with industry to minimize impacts on the industry moving forward from these whale entanglements. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Dale. Have a good day. Okay, Nikki, that wraps up the open public comment period.
I've got Rachel Bjork. She popped up.
Okay. All right.
She's the last one. Go ahead, Rachel.
Thanks. Sorry, Nicole, for my late hand raise. I thought there were more comments. I just want to take a moment to urge the commission to take the strongest possible measures to protect whales from entanglements. Any whale dying because they get caught in crab or fishing gear is a tragedy. And it doesn't really matter to the whale that is killed by this gear, whether they are a listed species or not. These whales are an important part of the ecosystem and they deserve the best chance at survival. These whales face continued threats and we don't need to continue to add to their problems by failing to do whatever we can to eliminate entanglements. Crab fisheries are indeed extremely dangerous, as the previous caller noted. Perhaps we need actual additional regulations to reduce the number of deaths that occur due to this extremely dangerous crab fishing industry. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your comments, Rachel. Okay. We'll go back now to the commission for any comments or questions of Heather. Fred, Commissioner Kuntz, you had your hand up, and then Commissioner Thorburn.
Yeah, I had my hand up before, and actually I was going to say a lot of the things that Larry and Dale just said, having to do with the plan. I was just wondering how the take numbers, which seem very reasonable to me based on today's data, but, you know, the data changes, you know, in 20 years is a long time. So I was, just like Larry and Dale said, you know, is there some easy way to, you know, sort of adjust automatically the numbers? And then the second comment I had was, you know, all this work, is tremendous, and it's a lot of work and necessary work. And I know we're preparing the conservation plan for the federal incident take, But, you know, in a way, it seems like there should be one conservation plan that is both for the ESA listed and the state listed. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe, you said, Heather, that you're putting information about the gray whales in there. But, you know, maybe, you know, like even the vision to, you know, keep a viable or, you know, an outstanding crab industry going and at the same time ESA listed, you know, maybe it should be ESA and state listed. Or maybe it should, you know, even be broader, as sort of like Rachel was saying, all the whales. But maybe there could be an appendix that shows the, you know, calculations of incidental take of gray whales, the state listed. So just an idea, because you're doing all this work, and it's easy for me to say, but it seems like without a tremendous amount of additional work, it could be a conservation plan that's for both federal and state. And we will need that when we go to revise the commission policy about entanglements, because then we will, you know, definitely be concerned about the sensitive species of gray whales.
Thank you, Commissioner Kuntz. Commissioner Thorburn, and then Commissioner McKaysey.
Sorry, I'm having a little bit of technical problems. My comments also reflect Fred's and our testifiers, Larry and all. Noting that, 20 years is a long time. And one of the things that's been sort of repeated in both our review of the status here and by our testifiers is the problem with the stock status data. I know we rely on federal agencies for that, but I certainly hope that, as has been called for in the testimony, that you know, we can get more timely data. I mean, one thought that I have is if we're successful and the whale populations are improving, chances are we'll see more entanglement just as an association of more whales as is going on with ship strikes. So we need to be able to respond to that in a 20-year period. The other example is what's going on with the die-off now with the gray whales. We need to be able to respond to that, it seems, in a 20-year period with the take adaptive management. And then one question that I have, strategies that we're using to prevent takes for whales, are they expected to be effective with leatherback turtles as well, that so far hasn't presented itself as a problem but could with the changing ocean conditions, or are there additional strategies that are needed? Do we know?
Well, specifically to the leatherback question, one, we don't have a lot of information about leatherbacks off the Washington coast. We're hoping that that's part of the improved science that goes on. But any opportunity to reduce lines in the water will reduce the risk of entangling not just a whale, but also a turtle. It's a little bit harder to say how effective they would be because we know less about where and when turtles are off our coast. I think they're more often a little farther offshore, but again, we're hoping that scientists get some of the funding requests and tools they need to specifically focus some of their work off Washington so we can address that better. But just reducing the number of lines will help.
Okay, thank you, Heather. Commissioner McKaysey. You got to unmute yourself, Don.
There we go.
There you go.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me also say thanks to Heather and all the folks involved in this effort. Just another outstanding presentation, Heather, and we really appreciate all the good thinking you guys have put into this to the beginning, from the beginning until now, on getting ahead of.
Don, your audio is horrible.
Problem and doing such a great.
No, not working, Don.
We see on the West Coast elsewhere. My question follows up both some of the thinking of Commissioner Thorburn and Coon.
Don, your bandwidth is low. Can you turn off your picture and see if that helps? Because you're not, we can't hear you or understand you, frankly.
How about now? Anything now?
That's better.
Yeah. My question had to do with normalizing for abundance for whales. Can you hear me now? Is that better? Still yes. Good? Oh, it is better. Okay. So if we have an increased number of entanglements, but it's just due to an increased number of whales, we don't know whether the program's effective or not. Where if the entanglements go down, but it's because the number of whales is going down, we don't know if the program is working or not. So on the Columbia River, we normalized for abundance to try to isolate policy effects. I presume you've thought a little bit about that, Heather. Have you, and is there a way to do that so you can isolate whether the program is working or not?
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, thank you for the question. And you're right. I think Commissioner Thornburn and Koontz had these very same questions. And I just want to say that that is a lot of the reason that we are not rushing to finalize this conservation plan, because I think the questions and possibly the solutions that you suggest will help us understand that better. And I know Commissioner McIsaac, we talked a lot in the groundfish council world about the rebuilding paradox, and you know how is that going to look as whales rebuild? It's what we want to see, but then do we see increased entanglements, and how do we tie those and associate them with our management tools is really what I think we need to resolve a little bit better before we submit our application and complete this conservation plan. So if the Columbia River and salmon maybe gives us an example of something to look at, I think we'll look to that if that offers us another way of looking at things that might help. So thank you.
Thank you.
Heather, great presentation. Thank you very, very much. And we'll move along to our next item.